But almost as soon as we moved our belongings back to Howard's house, it was just at the beginning of the rainy season, things began to happen, and that whole awful year began to unfold. Howard seemed worried or older or something. At night, he would wake up and call for Judy.
Just help me, please, darling. Come to me, please.
What is it, Father?
What?
Are you... what?
Another wave of nausea washing over me. I'm praying for death. Everything is dark. Everything sour. Terrible sounds. What have you brought me?
Look, Bob left his book for you.
Extraordinary. Yes, this is magnificent.
Dad?
This is a drawing of a building which... Did you hear something? God, what was that? Is there any cereal?
No, Dad.
First, there was the rock through Howard's window. Who had thrown it? Did it mean something? Well, the government certainly had people who threw rocks through windows or left unpleasant things outside certain doorways, but this might have been just a random act of vandalism by some depressed adolescent. There was no way to tell. And then at around the same time, my things started, you know, mental problems or whatever you'd call them. I don't even know how to tell the story or where I should begin it. I mean, mental phenomena, they're a little intangible, don't you think so? But anyway, it happened that there was a certain moment one day, not long after the rock, when I just said to myself, well, I'm going to spend a night away from this house. And so I packed a little suitcase and I went and spent a night just all by myself in a big hotel in a small town about 3 hours out on the railway line. Well, so late that night, I was lying in my tiny bed in my room in the hotel, and I was reading a book of poetry by one of our very finest authors. And all of a sudden, I began to hear sounds through the wall from the room next door. And the couple next door began to tease each other. They began to laugh. And while they laughed, they started kissing, and they started moving around in the room and falling into things. Well, suddenly, I was sitting straight up in my bed, and I knew I had to decide very quickly, immediately, in fact, what should I do? What should I do? Should I make an effort to continue my reading, or instead, should I listen to the couple next door, maybe with one of my hands sort of accidentally falling onto my dick? There was no time to think. The couple next door had stopped laughing now. They were groaning quietly with a sort of warm kind of gratitude. And so I put the book down quietly on my bedside table. And after the couple had finished making love, and it took a long time, they slowly drifted into silence. But I couldn't sleep. My hand reached out toward the book on the table, but then I thought, wait! Do I really want to go back to reading that book? Might I not actually, in fact, prefer to read the magazine that I bought in the lobby? The one with all the stories about healthy, well-exercised, rather young actresses. So I read for a while in that very engaging magazine, but I still couldn't sleep, and so once again I started to reach for the book. But as I reached for the book, my attention was drawn to the end of my bed, where a blank face looked expectantly into mine, a familiar framed screen which held inside it colors, songs, characters, drunkenness, love, beauty. And as I sat in the darkness and watched the screen for hour after hour, I thought to myself, well, at some point, we have to draw some distinctions, don't we? I mean, pardon me, but shouldn't there be some distinctions drawn between the things we say, the lies, the "I like poetry, I like Rembrandt" on the one hand? And I mean, of course it's important to say those things, because after all, if you don't say them, then you really become simply a zoo animal. You become an empty thing. You're nothing more then, really, than a large balloon with a mouth, genitals, paws, and an asshole, a nice great big one. But still, they're lies. They are lies. And then on the other hand, things that are true. Like, I'm watching this very nice screen right now. I'm watching it, and I'm enjoying it. And so, I came back to Howard's house, and days passed, and weeks passed, and I was sort of in a fog. I kept thinking nervously about all sorts of things. I was thinking a lot about the idea of the self, the self, the self, or as it's called from the inside, I, you know, this strange little thing that everyone has, this odd tiny organ which the surgeons can't touch. I remember being a boy and always reading these books which would refer excitedly to certain parts of the body as being generously endowed with nerve endings. And now I wondered if the self was. On the whole, I thought not. It probably had no nerve endings at all. Anyway, my mind was racing, speeding, in a peculiar condition, and one afternoon I found myself pacing back and forth in Howard's living room, as I often was on such afternoons, pacing and brooding, and I was sort of thinking about the fact that I always walked around with this extremely stooped posture, with my head sort of hanging down toward the floor, and I suddenly asked myself, why is that exactly? Could it possibly be because my head is too heavy? Because it's simply filled up with too much stuff, with these rather large trunks, suitcases, and worthless junk? And then I asked myself, well, what about that noise I always hear? That intolerable noise which comes from somewhere inside my head. And I realized consciously for the first time that, rather like a singer who accompanies his own singing on the piano or guitar, I accompanied my life with a sort of endless inner tinkling, an endless noodling or murmuring, a sort of awful inner murmuring of reportage and opinions, idiotic arpeggios of self-approbation. Yes, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm doing, and this is the right thing to be doing now, because murmur, and this is right, because murmur, and this is right, because murmur. I thought about all the sincere consideration which I gave to the future, to my plans, you know, and all the solemn concern I lavished each day on the events of my past, my memories, as we call them, wiping away a few tears. And I wondered, was all this really tremendously valuable? Or was it perhaps just a bit unnecessary when you consider the fact, rather often overlooked, that the past and the future don't actually exist? I sit around thinking about them from morning till night, but, you know, where are they? Where are they? I mean, they're not here. And God knows they're certainly not anywhere else, I would say. And so what is it supposed to mean to me if someone tells me that the trousers I'm wearing were worn yesterday by a man with my name, a man who did this, a man who did that, or that they'll be worn tomorrow by a man who's going to be doing something or other? It all means exactly nothing to me, because none of these people actually exist.
A few weeks after the rock through Father's window, there was a group of rather quiet demonstrations on some rather quiet streets. Now, obviously, in order to justify whatever dreadful measures the government wanted to take at any given unfortunate moment, they'd always say that the poor people who slept in the park were collecting weapons, or the rebels, the enemy, were about to come back again. And then they'd pay a bunch of people to pretend to be demonstrating, rioting, or whatever seemed appropriate. But somehow there was something about these particular demonstrations that seemed different. You kept hearing people say, wait, these could be for real. And then, perhaps as a consequence of these demonstrations, maybe not. Well, to use that perennially popular metaphor from cards, there were cabinet shuffles over and over. And every time that the big governmental deck would be cut, more people we'd never heard of would rise to the top of it. Was it a card game or a card trick? The old office holders, the filthy herd of swine, and we vaguely knew, and even vaguely nod to at cocktail parties, were quietly replaced by the new herd of swine whom we didn't know. The new generation, who dressed in new colors, yellow, pink, various greens, and lived in new neighborhoods, and even ate in new restaurants with new styles of cooking.
When I was growing up, I spent a lot of time with a rather fun uncle who had a lot of interesting opinions. And one of his opinions was that there were two kinds of people in the world, bunnies and rats. Bunnies were passive. They were happy to spend their lives nibbling away at a little patch of grass. And rats were active. They acted with fierce determination to get what they wanted for themselves. And naturally, they always ended up being better off than the bunnies. And my uncle thought that people were born either into one category or the other and really had no choice in the matter. And I remember his talking about our family and about his brother, Howard, whom he found unbearable. And I remember his telling me in no uncertain terms, look, We are rats. All of our family have always been rats. And you, too, will be a rat, my boy. Now, it's sometimes said that rats are narrow-minded, and of course they would be because of their narrow faces. And everyone always says that rats are greedy. Greedy rats. But my uncle said that it's the destiny of a rat to have a narrow face, and it's the destiny of a rat to have a sleek, fat, and healthy body. And that's why he told me that I should never be ashamed of being a rat. Rats aren't bad, he said. They're not mean or cruel. They use the minds that they have in the best way they know to make sure that their bodies stay healthy, fat, and sleek. Well, the point is that Howard, you see, in contrast to my uncle, was a rather contrary son of a bitch. He was born a rat. He was brought up to be a rat. But he sort of rejected his destiny and simply refused to act like a rat. Rats are supposed to do whatever they need to do in order to survive and flourish. But Howard petulantly declined to obey that principle and basically tried to convince himself that he wasn't a rat at all. And the story was the same with Bob and Arthur and all of their friends. And Judy, of course, was raised to believe that the worst thing in the world that a person could be was actually a rat. And so all of these people persuaded themselves that they were a race of tiny, innocent, sweet little bunnies who were horribly oppressed in this world of rats. This world where the government was run by rats, where the crude, survival-driven taste of rats was everywhere triumphant. And so eventually Howard, you see, became their great leader in a sort of imaginary war that they waged against all of the rats, a war against everything for which they held the rats responsible. From the unattractive figurines recently introduced into the sculpture garden to the lamentable fact that there were no more free concerts. And for about 15 minutes, I was invited to become a sort of foot soldier myself in the war against the rats, if you want to see it that way. Never mind you, asked to join the ranks of the officers' corps. Not quite the right material, I'm sure you understand. Now, isn't that sad? But perhaps almost worthy to be a low-grade sort of cheerful cannon fodder. But anyway, all this talk about war and soldiers brings me to the much-discussed question of enemies, you see. And that's a question that we really have to face. I mean, when people refer to quote-unquote the enemy, our enemies, they're referring basically to what someone once called the snarling, snapping, unmuzzled dogs. I love that phrase, the snarling, snapping, unmuzzled dogs. In other words, the individuals who live, so to speak, outside the fence, quote unquote. The ones who are camped on the other side of the fence with their campfires, their pots, their marshmallows, or whatever the hell they have over there. In other words, you see, if you look at the world as a whole, actually, most people in it are the ones we can only refer to rather nervously and gingerly by means of those terribly melodramatic and almost hysterical words like wretched, miserable, unfortunate, desperate, powerless, poor. That's a very sympathetic one. Or to put it a bit differently, God bless them. They're people who simply don't have any resources of any kind at all. And these particular people, and you know, God knows why, well, they just don't like us. They don't like us. They simply don't like us. So it's not hard to see what'll happen one day. There's the majority, them, the minority, us, and the way they feel about us. Great dislike. Very, very great dislike. In other words, these poor, desperate people aren't our enemies because we don't like them. They're our enemies because they don't like us. The important point to note, though, is simply this. Enemies are not exactly imaginary beings. They're very, very real. But I'll tell you something interesting about enemies, you see. At least this is how I feel about it. I'm sure you know that rather nasty and not terribly thought-provoking old saying that the enemy of my enemies is my friend. Well, what's really much more true to my sense of life is that the friend of my enemies is for sure my enemy. While in a funny way, my enemies themselves don't bother me that much. And at various moments, I can even work up quite a bit of respect for them, looking at it all from a certain point of view. It's that thing of people whom you actually know, and with whom you actually live, deciding consciously to become the friend of your enemies that can get you really terribly upset. Because your enemies, after all, are actually trying very hard to kill you, no matter what you may happen to feel about them. And this is where things with Judy and Howard really became so difficult, because they'd worked themselves around to being so horribly appalled by the disgusting rats that they saw encroaching everywhere on their perfect existence, that they ultimately decided that the people whom they actually ought to like were, yes, that's right, precisely the ones who were sitting around making plans to slice our guts out. Or in other words, to perform that gesture cleverly referred to by one of our enemy-loving writers as the disemboweling of the overbowled. And that became ultimately rather revolting to me.
You've been listening to The Designated Mourner by Wallace Shawn. I'm Andre Gregory, and I directed the production. The actors were Wallace Shawn as Jack, Deborah Eisenberg as Judy, and Larry Pine as Howard. Bruce Odland was the engineer, composer, designer, editor, and podcast director. Mastering was by Mark Fuller. The original producers were Celeste Bartos and Scott Rudin. Jennifer Tipton was the co-creator. These podcasts were produced by Mac Rogers and Sean Williams of Gideon Productions.